Good morning and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. It is 10 a.m. It is Saturday morning. That means it is time for books, writing and literary culture on Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel, and every week it is my absolute pleasure to help you discover new books, new writing, and meet the authors that bring it to you. Today is no exception. Before we get started on today's book, though, can I ask, have you discovered the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast? If you enjoy the conversations that I'm bringing to your radio, you may want to check out the podcast wherever you get your podcatching going on, because there is bonus content, there is outtakes, there is candid moments. This is more of the books that you love. And today's show, next week's podcast, is featuring Gregory Day, his new novel, A Sand Archive. And A Sand Archive is an extraordinary exploration of our relationship with the natural world. It takes us on a journey with a young engineer in Geelong in the 1960s through to Paris on the cusp of the student revolution of 68. And it really just has so much to say about Australia, our place in the world, and who we are. I can't wait to bring this conversation to you. It is coming up after this very short break. You're on 2SER 107.3, listening to Final Draft.
In a society inundated with technology,
one podcast will set out to document the weird, the wonderful, and mind-boggling stories of the digital age. Think Digital Futures.
Finding the human in the machine. Tune in 6:30 p.m. Tuesdays or 10:30 a.m. Sundays.
Brought to you by the University of Technology Sydney and 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. I'm joined on the line by Gregory Day. Gregory is a writer, poet, and musician. His first novel, The Patron Saint of Eels, won the Australian Literature Society Gold Medal. His other works include Archipelago of Souls and The Grand Hotel. And today we will be discussing his latest novel, A Sand Archive. Gregory, welcome to Final Draft. Thank you for joining me.
No problem at all, Andrew. Thanks.
Now, A Sand Archive. When a young writer happens upon a slim volume on dune stabilisation and the development of Victoria's Great Ocean Road, he finds himself captivated by an unlikely philosopher. Befriending F.B. Herschel before his death, the narrator feels compelled to discover more of the man. A life that takes him to the Paris student uprising of 1968 and delves into the meaning of humankind's interventions on our natural world. Gregory, I've just called F.B. Herschel a philosopher there, and that's something that very much unfolds through A Sand Archive. But F.B. Herschel is an engineer. He's seeking a solution to the movement of sand beneath the site of the proposed Great Ocean Road. It's a seemingly academic proposal, and yet he remains throughout the novel something of an enigma to the reader and to your narrator, even as this story unfolds through his diaries. The narrator acknowledges as much, wondering how much of Herschel he has actually created himself in interpretation. What was the relationship that you wanted us to have with Herschel?
Well, the book is, in some ways, it dwells in this kind of half-lit space between fact and fiction. And that is a territory that I find increasingly interesting, having written, this is my fifth novel. And they're all kind of, basically, what I think of my project in an overall sense, I feel like I'm attempting to build a map through books, through characters, through story, through sound, and through situations that I'm inventing. That map has a lot to do with my family, where my family arrived in Australia in 1841, the place where I've grown up and lived on the coast here in southwest Victoria, and all the connections to that place, which is just a small little town, but because of the history of this landscape, Aboriginal and post-Aboriginal, there's an enormous kind of level of layer and connection. And so I'm trying to build a map, and necessarily I think I have to increasingly, as I go on writing fiction, increasingly I have to acknowledge my doubts about whether fiction really, in a sense, actually exists. Even though I'm making up stories and making up characters, they're very much triggered by the world I live in, and very intentionally so. So F.B. Herschel is a character who exists in that half light. So there is a sense that the reader may feel, well, I know that readers have told me that they've gone looking up this character on Google or whatever.
I'll acknowledge. Sorry, I did.
Yeah, looking for this character, because there is a something in the style of the book that would make you believe that this person actually existed. That's part of the novelist's kind of illusory act, but in this territory, it's for me, it's also an intentional thing to question our stereotypes about what is a novel, what is non-fiction, and that we're all living in kind of an overlap of those two categories all the time, whether we're writing or not.
So, across the novel, and I think this may tap into what you were just discussing around this illusory sort of sense of are we fictionalizing our own world? Are we living in a novel? Across the novel, you set up a dichotomy between nature and culture.
Yeah.
Sous la pave, la plage.
Yeah.
Pardon my French. That as we layer ourselves with the trappings of culture, both spiritual and physical, yeah, we're inevitably separating ourselves from nature. But is this necessarily a true divide, do you feel?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, conceptually it doesn't make any sense. I mean, conceptually a skyscraper is as natural as a tree because it's come from the earth that we live on with the materials. If we've invented it and made it, and us being part of nature, our brains being part of nature, then it's natural, you know. But we have, of course, since industrialization, we do have this sense that we are living more in a built environment. And that what people like about nature is that they have this thing that there's no human hand, there's no deliberate kind of controlling act behind a tree or a bee or a river bend or so forth. Even though, of course, the climate, the cultivation, the cultural landscape has influenced those things. So there is a line you can draw to some extent, but of course that line, if you look at it too closely, always starts to shift. But what that's very much at the heart of what the novel's about for me, because we do live in a time where nature is kind of coming home to roost with the climate and our kind of lack of regard for it, and our sense, our kind of hubris about how we can do what we like with the nature we've been given and a part of. So in 1968, in Paris, there was this phrase, sous le pave, le plage, which the students would use and scrawled on walls in the middle of their uprising against the state. And that phrase means, under the cobblestones lies the beach. And that had to do with the fact that when they were fighting the riot police in the streets of Paris, one of the weapons they had was the cobblestones on the beach, on the streets, which they would dig up and hurl at the police. And of course, anyone who's laid cobblestones knows that underneath the cobblestones there is a bed of sand. And it became a symbol for kind of nature culture, the grid of the cobblestones over the kind of free ramble of the sand, the grid of nature, the grid of culture over nature, and the grid was represented by the university, the conservative France that had kind of cemented itself post-Second World War, and that the students in their post-structuralist fervour wanted to smash and break open. And although it's often seen as a political act, it's also a very significant, I think, cultural moment in terms of our relationship to nature. And I think the sous le pave, le plage phrase just symbolises that for me, and that came after the whole idea of the book, which was, you know, about this man who would go to France to research sand dune stabilisation for the purpose of working on the Great Ocean Road. That's all based on historical fact, but then the symbolism of the philosophical moment in Paris was just perfect kind of crucible for the theme.
In FB's travels, so he travels to Paris and then he later travels down to the Atlantic coast. I feel in these studies you enormously complicate this idea of the way we layer and structure and what is in itself natural. And so FB takes back the idea of using marram grass to secure the sand, and create the stability that he needs to create his road. And he gets that from the Atlantic coast, where similar efforts have been used over hundreds of years. And so for many people landing there, that would look like the natural world. But the marram grass, the way it has been shored up, is actually a grid layered over. Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I find that enormously complicating, that if we dig deep enough, everything that we understand is culturally influenced.
Yeah, cultural landscape. I mean, and for Australians, that should be such a central story to our understanding of what Australia as a white European culture is, because, you know, famously when white colonists first came here, they thought it was all natural. The constant references in the early text to the park-like landscape, like an English park. It's like a park. We walked through the trees and it was like a park. Bill Gammage has documented this in his great book, The Biggest Estate on Earth. Of course, it wasn't natural. It was very, very subtly cultivated landscape through fire stick farming by Aboriginal people. So that in itself is the greatest example I know of how what we presume to be natural is, of course, often not. Often it's natural, but it's a managed cultural landscape, and there's people's blood and sorrow and bones in the place, and it's not just terra nullius. Just as the coast, the French coast along near Arcachon, which features in the book, as you so rightly say, is a managed cultural landscape as well.
This is Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. I am in conversation with Gregory Day. We are discussing his new novel, A Sand Archive. We're going to take a break right now. We're going to have a track. This is from the Melbourne Cans, and it's called Baby Don't Be There.
Baby, don't.
Baby, don't be there. RCR wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
You are on 2SER 107.3. That was new from the Melbourne Cairns. The song was Baby Don't Be There. You are tuned in to Final Draft. My name's Andrew Popel, and right now I am in conversation with Gregory Day. We're discussing his new novel, A Sand Archive. And A Sand Archive follows the journey of F.B. Herschel from Geelong to Paris on the cusp of the 1968 student revolution. So in F.B.'s travels, he travels to Paris to learn engineering principles. He goes down to the coast with Mathilde, the woman he's fallen in love with, who happens to be from the same area. So she travels with F.B. and Professor Lacombe, and they see this coast, and in through both the love and also in the love between F.B. and Mathilde and F.B.'s experience, he has this world, this engineering puzzle, but his own heart sort of opened up to him. Did you want this experience, this travel that FB takes, to speak to Australia's relative isolation and our place in the world, or maybe just to the blindness, as you've touched on before, to our blindness to culture, be it internationally or there in the dispossessed, invaded peoples who had to, you know, make way when the, you know, bigger weapons came to land in 1788.
Oh, I think it's always an interesting question, you know, like when you're writing a novel, how much you intend, and how the energy has come to you to write the book. You're not writing an essay, so you're not actually just trying to prove a point. I think a good novel does more than that, but I do think that what I'm working on is a three-book project. Archipelago of Souls was the first one, where an Australian character goes to a place in Europe where a significant historical moment is happening, and then comes back to Australia, and so reflects on Australian culture through the prism of this moment that this the character has been exposed to in Europe. In the Archipelago of Souls, he was a soldier from this area who went and fought in Crete, home of classical mythology, during the Second World War, and then comes back. Here in the Sand Archive, it's a character from the Great Ocean Road going in and getting caught up in that philosophical moment. So it's very much, I'm very interested in the way that Australia fits into the tapestry of the rest of the world, and how we see ourselves culturally. And so by taking a character from a very small regional part, putting them into a central, famous, historical moment in France, and then bringing them back here. And so they look again. It's about looking again at how we are here and how we might be able to do things different, how we follow and how we unfollow.
Mm. Yeah. Liberty at the expense of the land is not worth considering. Professor Lacombe's words to FB, these plant the seeds of a personal revolution that is realised through the novel. And you have much to say about our modern sense of progress. You debate this philosophy between Mathilde's father and Lacombe. But do you have a sense that it's an issue that we can resolve, or that we even have the will to try and resolve?
Oh, look, I think amongst... It's one of those things where, you know... I mean, it's in the common vernacular where people say, oh, you know, they call it progress. I mean, the common ordinary person, I think, understands the kind of excesses and folly of ourselves as a society. But the wheels in motion that control the kind of structure of the way our world is built are now so inflated, and so the scale of it is so big that it is that, like the classic thing about trying to turn around a ship that is just so big and slow to turn around. And so there is a sense, isn't there, that there's some kind of race against time or something. You know, how can we change this fast enough to kind of save our skins or what have you? But I also think the bigger question is that it's not all about us anyway.
Mm.
And if we don't get saved, well, that might be better for all the rest of nature and the species that have just as much right to exist as we do.
Yeah. I want to take up, you just said there, can we change it fast enough? But you also discuss the idea that we are addicted to the sort of the blinding dazzle, what you call the cultural avalanche. And this is part of what was playing out in May 1968. Mm. And only to a different degree, but especially with the machines of social media, we have so much more of an addiction to the spectacle.
Yeah.
And how do you feel that that's shaped what we feel is important? Could we actually move back to this philosophy of Professor Lacombe's that the land, we move slowly with the land, we almost have to look at geographical time?
Yeah, no, I think it's not a matter of moving back or forward. I think that's part of, from my humble point of view, I just don't think the linear side of it, looking at it, is an answer. I'm not into nostalgia, I'm not into, you know, I think that's really, I mean, I have young children and I think about their future to come as, I do think of it as a real opportunity to bring nature and culture into some kind of workable balance. And with the social media and so forth, as we know, there's great stuff that comes from it. There isn't as well. The desire for the spectacle is both a superficial thing, also it's an explosion of narrative, if you like, and imagery in our life, which for creative people may be seen as a positive.
Are we addicted more to artifice, though? I mean, we see a lot now if we think about our understanding and our desire to understand nature.
Yes.
You know, sea changes, tree changes, everything's artisanal, but it's all, and this is framed as a cultural movement, but it can also, I mean, you know, too many people sea changing and tree changing is just going to destroy that environment. I mean, are we addicted to artifice? Can we see beyond it in a similar process that FB goes through?
Yeah, well, we are makers, you know, I think humans are makers. We don't have the tooth, we don't have the claw, we don't have the pelt, and we build our world, you know. I mean, there's no getting around that.
Mm.
So then it becomes down to what we build, how we build, how fast or slow we build. And, I mean, it's a know thyself thing, I think. You know, like if you can't be in denial about the fact that we are builders, we are makers. But, you know, like, there's a whole movement called biomimicry in architecture where you look at phenomena in nature to understand how best to build an environment that fits with it. There's lots of examples of it. One is the airbags in our cars, which NASA first developed, and it was based on the air sacs in the brow of the seabird, the gannet, which dives at 100 kilometres an hour into the water, fishing for food. And the only reason why its head doesn't explode is because of these subcutaneous air sacs. And so NASA take that and develop it. And now everyone's driving around in the car with these things. Nature just is, as any kind of geneticist will tell you, what we don't know about nature far outweighs what we do. And maybe the majority of the solutions for our own sakes lie in our being way more conscious, connected, and immersed in it. You know, not just a tree change as a stylistic thing, or as you say, a artisanal kind of mode, but to do it, not just to bring, I suppose, the coffee to the bush, but to infuse the coffee with the bush, something like that.
We skirt a very dangerous potential paradox there, though, in making, in creating, we inevitably destroy something. You want to erect something, you have to take those materials from somewhere else, and perhaps we spiral ever onward into this, trying to find that balance.
Well, but that's the case with nature, too. I mean, the forest floor is just the greatest example. Mm. It's just the forest floor is a thick litter of dying things that give more life than any living thing. You know, so maybe we've just got to accept that things die, but death brings life as well. I mean, this is the thing of, once again, of just our disconnect a bit. I mean, we want things to be clean, we want things to be safe, all that stuff. Well, if we are obsessed with cleanliness and safety, we're in big trouble, because nature and life comes from the muck and the you know, the humus and the things that are falling and disintegrating as much as it is anything else. So, I mean, a misunderstanding of that is just a terrible problem for us, I think.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Gregory Day. We are discussing the Sand Archive. And if the latter part of our conversation has you intrigued, there is so much to this book. I confessed off air to Gregory that I was drawn in by a novel ostensibly that I thought would be set in Geelong, a town that I love, and discovered so much more. So, Gregory, thank you so much. You've given me so much in this book and so much in this conversation.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Andrew. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
We have come to the end of the show. You're on Final Draft. It's 2SER 107.3. I have been in conversation with Gregory Day about his new novel, A Sand Archive. Before I let you go, I'm going to mention the podcast again, because if you enjoyed my conversation with Gregory, can I let you know that there is more? Bits that don't make it to air do make it to the podcast. If you want to find out a little bit more about Geelong, about why I love Geelong, I would tune in. The podcast goes up every Monday morning, and you can get it in whatever podcatcher. Just subscribe, give us a rating if you like it. The Vulture's Nest is coming up next, so don't go anywhere. And to get us there, this is from the feature album from last week. It is new from Fantastic Furniture. It's called Uncomfortable Teenager. You have been listening to Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. I'm Andrew Popel. I'll see you next week with more books. Bye for now.